there. But unfortunately, there's many on the left and there's many so-called Marxists who have interpreted the demand for the right of nations to self-determination again as some fixed principle for all cases, for all time. And that cannot be the case. And what's led is for these so-called Marxists to then support any national programme of any nationally oppressed group on the basis of this demand. They've done it throughout the world, they've done it in the UK. They see the national question and the question of the rights of self-determination as a black and white issue. Basically, what we must do is support the programme of the good nation, i.e. the good capitalists, as opposed to the bad nation, the bad capitalists. And they don't distinguish themselves from the bourgeois nationalists. Everything is very black and white, except often they're often the more militant. They're more militant often than the bourgeois, usually, of course, from a distance. And we can see that with the Czechs in Ireland and the Balkans and Palestine and Falklands, etc. They're basically saying any oppressed nation, doesn't matter what the programme is, we'll support it, because they're a nationally oppressed group. And that's a huge, big mistake. What we have to, of course, start again, first principles are, we are against all forms of national and racial oppression. That is black and white. We are opposed clearly to all forms of national and racial oppression, and we will fight against that, including the right to self-determination if a nation particularly wants it. But what we will not do, and where the dividing line is, what we will not do is support the working class of any nation subordinating its own class interests, or the class interests of the international working class, to the national programme of the bourgeoisie, and I'll come on to that in a wee minute, which seeks, of course, to enhance their interests only. We are opposed to oppression, but we have an independent class policy, not linked up to a policy of the bourgeois. And a successful struggle against, based on the premise that it's a practical premise, it's not some sort of sentimentality. The practical premise that if you want to be successful in struggling against exploitation, that requires the working class to be free of bourgeois nationalism and to be absolutely neutral in its fight for supremacy amongst the bourgeois nations. And that was the fundamental premise of Lenin's position on the national question. Because if the working class of any nation at all gives any support or credence to its own bourgeois programme, which basically is about its the chauvinistic programme of its own bourgeois, who wishes to further its own interests at the expense of other people's, might be other bourgeois interests, but it's still further its own interests, and it'll certainly be against the interests of the international working class. That will inevitably divide the international working class, of course, to the delight of the bourgeoisie. So Lenin quoted on this, "Bourgeois nationalism and proletarian internationalism, such are the two irreconcilable hostile slogans that correspond to the two great class camps throughout the capitalist world and express two policies, more than that, two world outlooks in the national question." So basically what he's saying is that the bourgeois have got their own particular interests, and they'll do their damnedest to make sure that they achieve them, and they're usually at the expense of the working class, and any credence any working class in any given country gives to that, that will usually be at the expense of other working classes of other countries. But the right of nations to self-determination was really only half of Lenin's position on the national question. The other side of the coin is, of course, total opposition to the division of the working class movement along nationalist lines. It's a complete difference to supporting the right of nations to self-determination and supporting nationalism. Because the most important weapon in the hands of the working class, as we all know, is unity. Anything at all which divides the international working class is to the benefit of the international capitalist class. So the right of nations to self-determination in no way means that Marxists cannot agitate against secession. So we can say in a given country that we support your right, but we actually don't believe that that would be good for the working class in your country or for the working class internationally. It's not in the interests of the working class, because it's if you divide England and Scotland, that will divide the labour movement. It will put back the cause of labour in Britain, and it will not be in the interests of the working class. We will support the right if that is what Scottish people want, but we will not campaign for it. In fact, we will campaign against it. There's a very distinct difference between these two points. So we are not at all obliged to support any struggle for any independence or any republican movement. It very much depends on the concrete circumstances and the implication for the cause of the working class locally and internationally. And that's going back to what I was previously saying about looking at individual circumstances in individual countries, etc. A good example of that, one example would be Ireland. The history of Ireland has basically been a struggle of ideas between socialism and internationalism around people like James Connolly, and the ideas of right-wing republicanism, Sinn Féin and the IRA. And of course Sinn Féin has actually, with some success, forced the Irish working class, or persuaded the Irish working class, to subordinate its class interests for the alleged interests of the national cause. What the right-wing Republicans seek to do is to blur the class lines and to promote this sort of imaginary unity of the Irish people. That's what all nationalists do. They want, it's the Irish people, it's the Scottish people, it's the Palestinians. Everything is, this sort of imaginary unity that the peoples of one nation have all got the same particular interests. And that's exactly what's happened in Ireland. The right-wing republicanism in Ireland stands for, theory of stages. Again, this is what most nationalist movements do. Stage one, let's get rid of the border. Stage two, maybe we'll be thinking about socialism after that. And James Connolly was totally opposed to such nationalism, which basically expects the working class to struggle to change its capitalist masters. So what we'll do is we'll get shot of the English capitalists, as Irish people, we'll swap them for the Irish capitalists. James Connolly says, if you remove the English army tomorrow and hoist a green flag over Dublin Castle, unless you set about the organisation of the Socialist Republic, your efforts would be in vain. England would still rule you. She would rule you through her capitalists, through her landlords, through the whole array of commercial and individualistic institutions she has planted in this country and watered with the tears of our mothers and the blood of our martyrs. England would rule you to your ruin, even while your lips offered hypocritical homage at the shrine of that freedom whose cause you betrayed. And the right-wing strategy, the Republican right-wing strategy of a nationalist sort of armed struggle, what's it achieved? It has achieved absolutely nothing. 3 decades of blood, sweat and tears in Northern Ireland has achieved absolutely nothing. The working class in Ireland have paid a heavy price for sweet FA, if we've been told. And what's the right-wing leadership done in Republican right-wing leadership done? They've basically made a deal with British imperialism, and the 32 counties, it doesn't feature whatsoever in that, and the border is certainly here to stay for a long, long time. But again, going back to first principles, we have to be clear that of course we are totally opposed to the oppression of the Irish people, which has been absolutely real and concrete. And we're totally opposed to the artificial border, which should be removed. But unlike the reformists with their so-called real politique and the sex, we have not supported right-wing republicanism, because we have refused to subordinate the interests of the working class to the demands of the nationalist bourgeoisie. Labour must wait. That's the practical policy. It's so practical that after 30 years they've achieved absolutely nothing. The most practical policy, and this is something we all get in the Labour movement, it's utopian, pie in the sky. Just fire that back at these people, because what have they achieved? Absolutely nothing. The most practical policy is one that Marx put very aptly, that the emancipation of the working class is the task of the working class and only the working class. And all right-wing republicanism has done is divided the working class to the advantage of British imperialism, and has achieved nothing, and has been a very good training ground for the British Army as well. And of course, the prospect of Irish unification is further away than ever. Our programme has always been a very practical programme, and that has been to fight oppression on a class programme, with a programme that was designed to unite both communities and against the capitalists, who we exposed as being the main cause of the troubles in Northern Ireland. And we will support all groups. We're not expecting all groups to be absolutely wonderfully 100% white and pure, but we will support all groups who are fighting for the cause of labour at home and internationally. We're going to go on to another example of a different example of the national question. That's on the Falklands. And I think that's a good example of how the national question can be a trap, again, if it's not analysed correctly. Our tendency has actually been heavily criticised by Marxists and so-called Trotskyists on that. And Alan's written an excellent document, which I would definitely recommend to people. If you haven't got it, you should get it, because even though you're not interested in the Falklands, it's actually very good on the national question. By the early 1980s, the military dictatorship of the Argentine junta was basically hanging by a thread. It was a monstrous regime. It killed over 30,000 people. They either died or they were missing. It had tortured and imprisoned many, many more. And by 1982, the junta in Argentina was completely discredited. Its economy was in difficulties, with huge unemployment, 150% inflation, massive strikes and demos. The junta itself was split. And the junta invaded the Falklands believing that British imperialism wouldn't fight. And they had very good reason to believe that, because there had been all sorts of intrigues and discussions behind closed doors about how the British really would be quite happy just to get shot of the Falkland Islands. And Galtieri, the leader of the junta, he was a very good friend of US and UK imperialism, and he actually believed for these reasons that the invasion, there might be a bit of noise about it, but it would not be opposed. And the reason the junta invaded the Falkland Islands and decided to do so was absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with national liberation, to reclaim the islands, which of course they declared that's what they were doing. For the junta, initially, the invasion of these islands was actually quite successful for them, because the revolutionary movement, which was gathering steam up until then, was dissipated temporarily. It was overwhelmed by patriotism. Unions actually cancelled strikes and demos, and the Argentine flag was getting waved instead of red flags. However, when it was clear to Galtieri, when he realised that British imperialism was going to fight, immediately he starts to negotiate with the British. And he even dropped a demand for sovereignty. He tried to negotiate some sort of deal, but by then, British imperialism and Thatcher's, you know, their prestige had been knocked, and Thatcher was demanding a complete and utter surrender. So the junta's whole actions really sort of showed that this was not a war of liberation of these islands. It was a reactionary move by a reactionary regime of gangsters, basically, who had killed 30,000 people to save their own skin. And it had not one ounce of progressive content whatsoever. Yet, the left and some Marxists supported Galtieri in his war against the British ruling class, or as they saw it, a war against imperialism. Why? The left's analysis was that Argentina was an oppressed semi-colonial country, and here we have British imperialism coming in its fleet to oppress the Argentinians. That was how they crudely sort of saw it. Therefore, we must support the Argentine bourgeoisie against the oppressor, which is British imperialism. Now, there might have been some argument there if the aim of British imperialism was to sail down to Argentine and bomb it and to invade it and take it over. There may be some argument there. But really, the aim of British imperialism was actually just to go and save it, as I say, increase its own, restore its prestige and to regain possession of the islands. It had absolutely no intentions of invading Argentine. And secondly, Argentine was not a third world country. It couldn't have been declared as a third world country. It might have been being destroyed by the junta, but it was not a third world country. Also, there was not a single Argentine living in the Falkland Islands. Not one. There's not one there. In fact, the islanders themselves were not a colonially oppressed people. Quite on the contrary, they were absolutely, shit scared that, they were going to end up oppressed by the junta, who'd obviously invaded them, and all the islanders were opposed to it. Now, we opposed the British fleet sailing off because that was an imperialist act. They're, the big British imperialism sailing off to try and protect its conquest. But what kind of liberation is it? How can you support a liberation movement which is its aims are to abolish all democratic rights, which of course the junta would have done to the islanders, reducing them to some sort of servitude? What where was there anything progressive in that? It was a whole line, it was a complete and utter deception, really just to save the skin of the junta. But unfortunately, a lot of Marxists and people on the left couldn't see through that. It was a continuation of the junta's domestic policy dictated by the need to survive. So many of the Marxists on the left basically allowed themselves to be carried away with the prevailing mood of society. And they basically saw the question as black and white again, Argentine against British imperialism, on the wrong pretext. And this is where the analysis comes in. It's so crucial, on the wrong pretext that Argentine was some semi-colonial country. And in fact, if the junta had succeeded, it would have been even worse for the left and the Marxists in Argentine, because that would have definitely consolidated their power for much longer. Was it permissible for the sake of a few islands that had no Argentinians in it whatsoever to forget about the 30,000 dead that the Argentine junta had killed and countless more tortured, to then hold hands with this junta? We didn't see so. We couldn't see so at that time, and I think we were absolutely, absolutely right. So what was our position? Our position was that at no time did we support this Falklands War. It was two capitalist class that were basically fighting it out between them. The British working class had absolutely no interest in the Falkland Islands or even maintaining control of them. We at the time called for a general election to get rid of the Tories, for Labour to come in on a socialist programme, for our Argentinian brothers and sisters to overthrow the junta. Then we could solve the question of the Falklands. in a free and voluntary basis. Now, on the basis of our position at that time, nothing more could really have been asked of us. Because from a Marxist point of view, the voluntary union of people is all we're interested in. We're not interested in any other union, but the voluntary union of people. And again, the practical policy is that on a capitalist basis, an equitable solution to the national question isn't possible. Because it always ends up in one group or one country violating the rights of another country. That is what it means under capitalism. But from our point of view, we're talking about the voluntary union of peoples. And it's only the working class that can bring about a fair and equitable solution to the national question by taking power. Not easy, but it's the only practical solution. And as Alan says in there, which I think is a great quote, the right of nations to self-determination is for people, not for rocks. And I thought that was a great quote. We cannot support every military adventure launched by the bourgeoisie or any of bourgeoisie of former colonial countries to seize land and resources to save their own skin. So the left position began and ended with the Malvinas belongs to Argentina, without properly analysing what that meant in the current context. And if you read that document, it goes into it in a lot greater detail than I'm able to do. And the Argentine's junta, the junta's relationship with imperialism was not one of some sort of oppressed slave, but actually as a junior partner to imperialism. So Marxists are not compelled to take sides. This is something that happens in the labour movement all the time. Who do you support? What side are you on? We are not compelled to take sides when rival ruling classes are in conflict. We are on the side of the international working class, and it's in their interest that we take our positions and our actions. So I think Falklands is a good example of the need to analyse and be flexible and really work out what you're doing. So finally, I'm going to talk about the national question in Scotland. The national question in Scotland has lain dormant for many a decade, and it revived itself in the 1960s. A lot of disillusionment with the Labour government at the time. And the fortunes of the Scottish National Party have yo-yoed basically since then. Very much linked, if you look at it, the figures, very much linked to the disillusionment with Labour and also around the activity of the Labour movement in general. In 1959, the SNP's share of the vote was 0.8%. In fact, in the 1950s, the Tories were the biggest party. They had the most seats in Parliament in Scotland, and now I think they've got one. So the SNP's share rose to about 22% in February 1974 and 30% in October 1974. There was two elections in 1974, and that was also helped by the discovery at that time of North Sea oil. Then there was quite a revival of the Labour movement in the mid to late 1970s, and the support for the SNP actually slumped to, I think they had about 11 or 12 MPs, and then it went down to 2 MPs. In the 2007 Scottish elections, the SNP, vote for the SNP went up again to about 30%, and are now really the main alternative to Labour in Scotland. Now, while it's true there are many English areas in England which suffer much poverty and much deprivation, that's clearly true. But the crisis of British capitalism has had a particularly devastating effect, I think, to the whole of Scotland, or to large swathes of Scotland. Scottish workers are the sickest in Europe. You've all seen it on the television, In one of the wards in Glasgow, the average age a man dies is 69 years of age. That's in Shettleston, which is absolutely incredible. 69 is actually on a par with many third world countries. One in four children are considered to live in poor households. One in four suffer fuel poverty. There's at least a million people classified as poor in a country of 5 million people. Is it any wonder, with the Labour leadership that we've got, that some workers are turning to nationalism to look for a way out? And of course, the current nationalists are very clever. They're not going about, you know, talking about these, you know, bad English or whatever else. You know, they embrace the English. What they want to do is, a Scottish nation, we want to run our own affairs and use the money that we've got and the money that we could have if we were independent for the benefit of everybody. You know, that's what nationalists always say. The nationalists are against the Iraq war. They're against Trident. The most recent one is they're going to build all these council houses, and they're going to stop the sale of council houses for new houses, something we'd clearly support. And of course, we always take a sympathetic attitude to workers and patiently explain around nationalism. But the nationalists are very clever. They got, you know, it wouldn't be hard, but comparison to the Labour Party, they're, you know, revolutionaries. But of course, about us patiently explaining is that we are opposed to independence, and it is a class opposition. An independent Scotland, for all the reasons that James Connolly said there, an independent Scotland would not solve a single problem for the working class in Scotland, and it would pose dangerous social and political divisions. All you would do is you would still have your Scottish capitalists, and what difference would that make? Also, the unity of the British Labour movement is a colossal historical conquest that we as Marxists should defend. And that's what we have to explain to people, that it's not a switch of, you know, which capitalists run Scotland. It's about supporting socialist policies. Of course, we supported devolution as a democratic demand, but we're implacably opposed to nationalism because it seeks to divide the working class and its organisations, and there's going to be absolutely no compromise on that question. Again, it says one nation approach, which is based on the interests of the bourgeois. Scottish nation, we've all got something in common, therefore all we need to do is get rid of, you know, the English, the English system, and everything will be hunky dory. Now, actually, I'll give you some figures actually on this. You can pass these around. It just gives you some. You might have to share about the elections. This is just to give you a bit of a picture of what happened at the last Scottish, the Scottish elections. Basically, as you can see, I've written some figures down there. Labour overall only lost 4 seats, but the Nationalists won 20 seats. And the vast majority of these 20 seats was basically the SNP picking up all the other odds and sods. So it picked up the senior citizens one, the Save Stop Hill Hospital, Falkirk West MSP, the Scottish Socialist Party, all of their 6, the Green Party, got 5 of their votes, and 1 Tory and one Liberal Democrat. And was 4 down for Labour. So you can see a polarisation there of votes in Scotland between Labour and the Scottish Nationalist Party. And as you can see, the arithmetic is that the Nationalists have 50 seats and the non-Nationalists, if you want to call them, have 79 seats. So when they talk about having a referendum about Scottish independence, they don't have the figures there, the numbers there to get that through. We also look, some of you have got some coloured maps behind, which always is quite interesting because, as you can see, the red is obviously Labour, and the working class areas in the Central Belt have literally not changed since 1999, hardly. We've got Govan. Govan's one of these peculiar ones that seems to get every now and again. But the working class areas have solidly voted for, continue to vote for Labour, despite Labour. So that just gives you some idea of the situation in terms of votes. Now, the fate of our old chums in the Scottish Socialist Party is another example of how a wrong analysis of a national question can just sort of lead to ruin. Now, if you remember, the Scottish Militant Labour was set up, one of the key reasons it was set up, that was before it formed into a separate party, was to win the disaffected youth from the SNP. They needed to break with Labour, and they were putting forward a sort of a Scottish Socialist Republic. Now, at first, of course, that looked as if it was working. They got 6 seats in Parliament, and they had about 15% of the vote. Their youth wing, the SSP youth wing, was growing and looked quite active. And they seemed to be winning over quite a lot of frustrated workers. I went along to one of their meetings, and it looked very working class to me. It didn't look petit bourgeois, it looked working class. They had a lot of people that were really pissed off with Labour, basically. But of course, they were totally rejoiced in 2003 when they won all these seats, and it really seemed as if they had made, to them, as if they had made the right decision. They declared at the time that the Scottish nationalism was progressive in some form. In fact, the fact that a lot of people were supporting the Scottish nationalists, particularly because the Scottish nationalists were quite left-wing, this was really a sign that the Scottish working class was really standing up for itself, you know, against Westminster and the establishment. And even going so far as saying that it was a sort of an immature Bolshevism, you know, that it was, you know, the Scots were really standing up for themselves against the establishment. They relentlessly have attacked Labour, while continuously and relentlessly, in a way, talking about how radical the SNP are, but we need to win the youth from the SNP. Now, how do you actually do that? We've always said this. How do you do that? By pandering to nationalism. And in their website, it's all about, you know, Scottish Socialist Republic. It's all about how, you know, they're constantly pandering to nationalism, yet wish to win over the youth from the SNP. And what actually these figures have shown is that people have decided, well, why go for the pretenders when we can have the real thing? They've been absolutely crushed by the SNP, so I don't see how they could possibly say that the policy has worked. And Alan McCombs, after the election, said in a heading saying, "The day Scotland's rainbow parliament turned grey," by Alan McCombs. "By any standard, this was a massacre for the left. The red-green presence in Holyrood, represented by the Scottish Socialist Party, the Greens and Solidarity, was slashed from 15 to 2. The emergence of the SNP as the biggest party in Scotland by the narrowest possible margin will not lead to instant independence, the removal of nuclear weapons from the Clyde, or even the demise of the council tax. But it is likely to open up a new turbulent phase in Scottish politics, a time of strife, which could accelerate the ultimate breakup of the United Kingdom and pave the way for the resurgence of socialism." Although Solidarity polled more votes than the SNP, which is quite funny, the failure of Tommy Sheridan in Glasgow was the biggest shock result of the night, leaving Solidarity activists visibly traumatised. Despite the party's, meaning the SNP's, cosy reapproachment with elements of Scottish big business, many left-wing voters including, it appears, most of those who voted SSP in 2003 swung behind the SNP in this election. It amazes me how they write these things. They don't see the, you know, maybe they don't read what they've written before. And what was the other one? A large part of the solidarity vote was an expression of sympathy for Tommy Sheridan, based on the confusion and misunderstanding of the facts that led to the split in the socialist movement, rather than a conscious socialist vote. Right, this is the one I was looking for. The SSP can report numerous examples of voters, including even party members, marking their X against Alex Salmond, then scrolling down the regional list to vote SSP. All of these votes would have been discounted. So they're actually admitting there that their own members' first vote was for Alex Salmond and the SSP, and their second vote, as you know, with the voting system, was for the SSP, and they're complaining because of the, you know, the fact that all of these votes were lost. It's utterly unbelievable. Also, the SNP, I'm going to be finishing shortly, the SNP have set up this thing called a national conversation. Because of the arithmetic, as I've showed you there, they're trying to whip up support for independence in a referendum around independence. So to try and get this going, they've set up this national conversation. And in the SSP website, they're all in favour of this. The Scottish Socialist Party welcomes the coming national conversation on Scotland's future. And it goes on, you know, etc., etc., about that, you know. So they're all completely jumping on the coattails of the SNP. And, you know, they're just a total, complete and utter mess. So, in conclusion, comrades, to repeat myself as the key issues, the working class of any one nation cannot support the privileges of its own bourgeoisie. That will inevitably arouse distrust amongst the working class of other nations and divide the working class. The national question is not easy, because we have to always analyse the precise class content of any war or class struggle. We have to determine what class interests lie behind and what implications there are for the working class. It's not about repeating blind slogans of the rights of self-determination or anything else, or necessarily choosing between the good bourgeoisie or the bad bourgeoisie. Bourgeois nationalism is founded on the premise of a common cause. We all are in it together. That Labour must wait, what the socialist programmes in the back burner, and it's the bourgeois demands of getting rid of the border, whatever it is, which is put to the front at the expense of everything else, and it always leads to a betrayal of the workers. Bourgeois nationalism, in essence, is about swapping one capitalist master for another, and must always be exposed as a deceit. We are completely and utterly uncompromising against all oppression and exploitation, but we start with the proposition for workers' unity against exploiters at home and in solidarity with the working class internationally. That is not for sentimental reasons, but for as a practical policy, as it's been proved time and time again, that is the only possible way to abolish oppression. Now, like the programme of reformism and Stalinism, nationalism can be a formidable obstacle, and I think we all know that from our work in the Labour movement. It can only be overcome by correct strategy and tactics on the national question. And I'll finish with a quote from Trotsky. All state frontiers are only fetters upon the productive forces. The task of the proletariat is not to preserve the status quo, i.e., to perpetuate the frontiers, but on the contrary, to work for their revolutionary elimination with the aim of creating the socialist United States of Europe and the entire world. And that, I'm finished.
Right, thank you.